Mobile home parks don't fail because the thesis is wrong. They fail because operators underestimate systems, capital, and discipline. And today we're going to go inside how institutional investors actually separate durable cash flow from hidden risk. Welcome to the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. I'm Kevin Bupp. This show exists to help investors understand what really drives durable cash flow, and more importantly, what equally destroys it. Today's guest, Brad Johnson, brings a rare dual perspective to that conversation. Brad is the co-founder and CIO of Vintage Capital and has over 20 years of commercial real estate experience and roughly $3 billion in acquisitions across multiple asset classes, including deep hands-on experience in mobile home parks. In this episode, we're going to go beyond the surface-level mobile home park thesis and talk about what actually moves NOI from systems and automation to operator discipline, all the way to capital structure decisions that most investors never see. We're also going to dig into where investors are most likely to get hurt over the next 24 months, and what limited partners should be verifying before wiring capital into a park deal. This conversation isn't about chasing yield. It's about avoiding preventable mistakes in one of real estate's most misunderstood sectors. And before we get into the show, guys, I would appreciate it if you'd hit the follow button wherever you get your podcast or subscribe on YouTube to get notified when we drop our new shows. Brad, welcome to the show. Well, love if you take a few minutes to tell us a little more about yourself. And I think, you know, more importantly, even is how you found your way into the world of mobile home parks.
I come from a real estate institutional background, you know, worked at a big firm doing a lot of deals. The last deal that I worked on was literally a $1 billion skyscraper in San Francisco. So it's real estate investment banking. And, you know, I was just a cog in a giant machine. You know, it was great. I learned a ton. But I always had this entrepreneurial itch, and I always wanted to, which I think is pretty common with real estate investors, is they want ownership. They want to get on the owner side, the buy side at some point, even if they work in investment banking, brokerage, on the sell side. So I decided that, you know, after I had my first kid in San Francisco, that I was either going to do it then, you know, when the stakes were a little bit lower, and we didn't have this giant house and this giant overhead, I was either going to go off on my own into an asset class and become an entrepreneur then, or I was never going to do it. And I was looking for something that was pretty niche, because my philosophy was that nobody was going to give me $50 million to go buy an office building in San Francisco as my first deal. But you could probably carve out a little, you know, section for yourself if you go with something that's a little different, a little below the radar, that has some unique characteristics to it. And as we know, manufactured housing certainly has that. And so that's what I did. I also happened to see the, you know, being on the institutional side, I had the benefit of seeing the numbers, how these things performed nationwide. And you could see the historically crazy low default rates. And yet I knew that the yields were higher, especially back then. This is 12 years ago, 13 years ago. The yields were really high. And plenty of debt service coverage, right? So I was like, well, those two things shouldn't go together. Usually it should be the opposite, right? Things that are higher risk, you know, should ultimately have higher returns, not the opposite. So anyways, I decided to go ahead and leave and partnered with somebody who had more operational boots on the ground experience. I was more of the investment guy. And we went out and bought a bunch of parks all over the country, made some great buys, made some mistakes. But that was how I got into the space.
What do you believe to be the case as to why, you know, 12, 13 years ago, why more institutions didn't have an interest in the sector? I mean, you just said as much, that the yields were high, risk was low, right? I mean, like, kind of the perfect storm, right? It should have had everyone clamoring to invest capital into this niche, but not until really the last, what, maybe 5 to 7 years has there been such a major shift and big move from institutions trying to pour billions of dollars into this, you know, somewhat limited space. That wasn't the case 12, 13, 14 years ago. Why do you think?
Well, besides the obvious stigma thing, the reality is that the large institutional firms that raise money from endowments, from insurance groups, from pensions, they are really, you know, they are really handcuffed by those investment boards. And if those guys are saying, hey, we can't have headline risk of you increased lot rent on a community, and this big private equity firm is taking over a mobile home park and people can't afford to live there anymore, but the actual LPs couldn't take that risk and so wouldn't let the real estate operators go pursue that niche, even though the math and the returns made all the sense in the world. And of course, you and I know there's a responsible way to do this and run these parks where you can avoid that drama. And so that was really, I think, the main driver. It's not like this was a secret 12 years ago. It was in the retail world, right? But the institutions knew ELS, right? Sam Zell, right, has been a publicly traded company, you know, in this space for a long time. And so people would see the returns from ELS and be like, wow, like something's there. But they could not get the investment committees and their underlying LPs on board with that plan. And so they just stayed out of it. That has started, obviously, to trickle the other direction. These large firms are coming into the space. But there's still, you know, a large group of LPs that still are like, I don't know. Well, maybe you can do expansion or you can do development, because then we'll be adding new supply as opposed to, you know, kicking out grandma, which is what they have in their head, even though that's not the case. Like this industry is in desperate need of more capital, more institutional, professional operators. It's gotten a lot better over the last 10 years, but it needs to get even more professional in order to take care of these properties, which most of them have had deferred maintenance for 30 years that have not been addressed. And so we need to keep inching that direction.
Does your crystal ball really tell you? I mean, so like, you know, I would probably argue that there was a period of time that, you know, traditional multifamily was had a lack of consolidation, lots of mom and pop, you know, operators in the space, even some of the larger, you know, communities, 100, 200, you know, door communities. And, you know, over the last probably four decades, it's now predominantly consolidated and owned by larger institutional groups, at least the stuff that's 150, you know, doors and larger. I believe it's happening. But like, is there a time where we find ourselves in the same vein to where, you know, 90% of MHPs are consolidated and it's a more professionalized asset class and just has a lot more consistent standards in place? You believe we'll be there at some point in the next decade or two?
I don't know if it will be a decade. It might take 20 years. I've been surprised at how slow it is to actually consolidate. I actually thought when I sold my portfolio that we would be closer than we are today, that's for sure, to consolidation. But it's taking a long time because a lot of these sellers know what they have, right? And they're not in a rush to sell because it's kicking off all this tremendous cash flow and they have a really low basis and they're going to get hit with this big tax thing, tax bill. So it's happened slower than I thought, but 100%, it will someday be just like multifamily, where instead of buying from mom and pop, you will be buying from other operators. Just, you know, that happens all the time. And so some people would talk to me about, well, I only want to participate in this space while it is, you know, inefficient, while it is in the consolidation phase, which I'm like, why would you, you know, there's plenty of people that have made billions in this, in the multifamily world, buying from other operators just at the right point in the cycle, or having a better operational team that can drive NOI growth. So there'll always be money to be made in this space. It just will be different players, you know, 20 years from now, 15 years from now.
How was your business evolved from the time that you got into the space? Obviously, you linked up with an operator, boots on the ground guy, and started buying lots of communities throughout the U.S. What does your business look like today compared to what it looked like back then?
Back then, you know, as you know, you couldn't just hire a third-party group. You had to really kind of build out the property management team. And so I found myself, just from the circumstances of our partnership, I found myself running a 30-person property management team with all the on-site maintenance people and property managers. And I was like, this is not exactly what I was hoping to do, because there just wasn't, you know, a lot of third-party managers. There's more today, but still, if you're doing a value-add deal, you really, you need to be,
you got to be hands-on.
You got to be hands-on. And that's just not who I am. You know, I was a serviceable operator. I was pretty good at it because I had to be, but I am a better investor and allocator. And that's our business today is partnering with groups and leveraging our network and our portfolio of operators that we've done deals with for the last 7 years. And seeing more deal flow from across the country, and then putting together portfolios for our investors. And so that's the main part of our business. And then we also do some platforms where we've actually put an operator with a private equity group and stood up $30 million platforms, where you're taking a group that, you know, maybe they've just kind of run into a point where they can't grow anymore, and they really want to get to more institutional capital and do hairier value add deals. And we bridge that partnership and put that together.
I'm going to take this not from the 101 perspective, but probably from the 102 perspective, you know, about where we add value in mobile home parks. I mean, there's the, you know, the very common operational levers that we talk about, this, you know, loss to lease recapture, you know, passing back water and sewer charges, you know, changing tenant quality, converting park-owned homes, like all those pretty common things. But I'd like to take this from the opposite direction and, you know, from your, you know, couple decades worth of experience, you know, first kind of building out the business yourself and now working with a number of operators, successful operators in different parts of the country that have been in the, you know, park sector for a decade plus. You've seen a lot, right? You've seen it from all different angles. I guess maybe from your side, like, what do you see to be some of the silent killers of park performance that even maybe sometimes seasoned operators might underestimate?
You know, it's taking care of the small things. It's literally not having systems to quickly pass out notices when the lawn is growing too high, or when somebody is 15 days late on rent. The groups that don't have somebody with an engineering mindset to build out the automation capabilities with the software platforms like Rent Manager, Manage America, even AppFolio to an extent. If you don't have somebody on the team that is wired to think like that, that's kind of my biggest red flag, is when there's two finance guys together. And why do I know that? Because that's exactly what I started out in the business. We were two finance guys put together that were really good at the Excel modeling and the fundraising and the thesis. But like, we didn't have an engineer or somebody that was just super detailed that would literally would go into the modules and map out the automation flow and just do the, you know, mind-numbing, boring work to put those systems in place so you can just know that things are running like a machine, you know, day in and day out, regardless of your own individual manpower. That's the biggest, you know, red flag for me, is that it's really easy to fall in love with the thesis in this space, of course, right? And it's really hard to build out that team and those systems without somebody that is just all over the minute, the minutiae.
Yeah, again, to your point, you can make the model look as pretty as you want, but someone's got to be, you know, where the rubber hits the road. Someone's got to be able to execute upon that model. And I, again, you can buy right. You can buy based on the model. Everything looks great, but if you don't execute, you could sure as hell still lose your butt, right?
And it happens slowly, right? It's like, somebody stops paying on time and then they start telling their buddies in the unit across the street, right? And then they're like, wait a minute. And then when something happens in their life where they're like, I could use a loan, like, oh no, I know, I'll let the manufactured landlord community lend me the lot rent this month, right? And it just kind of snowballs from there. So yeah, those small details matter in this space.
Yeah, some of the areas that I've seen that we, you know, maybe even personally that we've experienced maybe way back when we got in the space and just kind of learned from some mistakes is, you know, a lot of these parks were built, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, sometimes older than that even. Is the infrastructure is not taking the time to dive deep enough and build budgets around infrastructure upgrades, repairs that inevitably will have to happen. And you might be able to limp it along. You might be able to patch it along and make it last another, you know, years or maybe even decades. But I've seen a lot of new operators, you know, find themselves in troublesome situations with either, you know, failing septic systems or, you know, wastewater treatment plants. That's why those things scared me originally way back when. Probably because Frank Rolfe used to, like, you know, put the fear of God into you about how bad those things were. And if they failed, it was going to cost you $1 million. And we've never had that issue. We own a number of them, have owned a lot of them over time. You know, I'd say wells are probably one of the more trickier ones. You can't really poison anyone with a wastewater treatment plant, but you sure as heck can do so if you've got a failed aquifer, or, you know, you've got, you know, heavy metals in your water and you're feeding it to your community. And so I've seen folks make mistakes there as well, which they just haven't, they don't dive deep enough into the infrastructure piece of it. Especially private utilities and the model goes awry if you don't budget for those types of items. So is that something that when you're looking at putting capital with an operator, how deep are you guys looking into their respective due diligence? I know today you're capital allocators for the most part. And so you're really vetting other operators like Sunrise, like ourselves out in the space. And how deep of a dive are you doing to ensure that they're actually, you know, crossing all the T's, dotting all the I's, when it comes to due diligence on a respective park?
Yeah, so it depends on the size of the deal and how long I've invested with that group and how well I know them, right? There's some groups where I've gotten past that phase where we don't have to get in the war room in their diligence files and look at their actual documents to know that they are being diligent and are looking at all those things. But just as a starting point, if it's a new relationship for us, we're not doing a wastewater treatment plant. We're not doing well with a newer group. Because as you mentioned, you know, those are the things that really can blow up a deal. I generally have just always avoided treatment plants. We've done one of them on a new build, which was, you know, $1.2 million plant, but the deal was a $20 million deal. So it's like, if the deal is large enough, we will do, you know, a private system, but we tend to focus on public utilities, with septic, right? With septic, I'm totally comfortable with. If there's excess space. And the thing about utilities is that it used to spook me a lot in the beginning. That's actually not my biggest concern today. Like the pipes breaking, the roads having issues like that. When I started, I was like that. I was overly focused on that. But those are solvable with capital. So I agree. You can't go with a group that there's so many groups that will like raise just enough money to get through closing with like a $30,000 reserve budget. And that's the only capital they have access to if something pops up. So we're shying away from those groups, but we also have ways to solve that problem. We can inject new capitals in the deal. So I would rather take infrastructure risk to an extent, right? Than I would take demand risk. Like that's where I tend to focus on more of the due diligence is not on, hey, what are, you know, are these clay pipes or are these PVC pipes, right? We ask the questions, right? We want to know that people are being thoughtful and are getting them scoped and you know, doing a camera line run, sure. But I am more concerned about the demand side of the equation on most of the markets and, you know, how many park-owned homes there are and do they have the team to actually pull this off than I am on the infrastructure because that is a solvable problem with capital. The returns won't be as good, but it's generally not a zero.
No, I agree. Well, let's dissect the demand piece of it, and just maybe you know your definition of what that means and what's good demand versus not so great demand. Because I think for those that have not invested in this asset class, I think you go out so you listen to a bunch of podcasts. There's lots of information out there that's readily available today. You would almost draw the thesis that like this works everywhere, right? There's an affordable housing crisis across the country. So if I can just buy a park, no matter where it is, there's demand for that product. And that is not necessarily the case. And so maybe speak to that if you would.
I kind of fell in love with the thesis starting out and it was fine because we were buying 10 caps, right? So if you went to a softer market and you had that much margin of error and you're going into a declining interest rate environment, you can get bailed out. And so today, you're not going to get that kind of pricing for most larger parks, of course. And so if you go to a soft market, then what happens if, sure, there might be unlimited demand for affordable housing, but if the incomes and the jobs can't support any sort of lot rent increase, it doesn't matter how overwhelming the demand is. There is a certain level of income that you just have to get in order to make the math work on 5-7%. Lot rent increases over time. And plenty of markets, you know, in the Midwest and the Rust Belt just don't have those dynamics to support that. And so yeah, I think people get in trouble falling in love with a thesis and you know, they go to a market that they think, oh, just because it's in a 100,000 person MSA, which I hear all the time from people, and I'm like, I don't know why that seems to be written in stone for some people. That hasn't, you know, yes, it's nice to be in a bigger market, but you would rather see a bunch of different demand drivers and income metrics that could support your underwriting. So we tend to focus on above average markets. And I will, like I said, I would rather be able to throw money in infrastructure and homes and improve the quality of the appearance of the park than maybe go to a nicer park that is an hour and a half outside of an MSA or a market that is a little softer.
How do you define an above average market? I mean, is there, you know, I guess based on median home prices, median incomes, what are some of the other demographics that you that you're looking at, and then what's kind of the baseline of a above average market for you?
Yeah, 250K above median, you know, home value is a great sign. You know, 300, 400 is obviously amazing. It's funny. I tend to think the world has shifted in the in our space where it used to be for real estate, the core markets were, you know, New York and Southern California, and you couldn't pay me to own or invest in a park in either of those cities. So for us, like, you know, we invested in a deal in Omaha, Nebraska. That to me is a new core market within manufactured housing. And you wouldn't think it, but it, you know, it's very stable employment, growing, you know, incomes, high occupancy in all the parks in the area downtown. So, you know, the markets have shifted in terms of what is a core and what is not a core. And that is exacerbated with rent control, right? Portland and Seattle, those used to be core markets. Now those are tougher markets to do business in. You got to be very thoughtful before going into those areas of the country. So yeah, I tend to just first, you know, easy back of the envelope metric is housing prices, because you just know that, you know, you're going to have a giant gap on, you know, the value that you're giving these tenants if stick-built homes are 300,000.
And I'm assuming that way of thinking applies to, you know, major infill projects as well, right? Like, you want to know that there's a high median home price, you know, the rents in the area incredibly high or above average.
Oh, it's even more important. Yeah.
You know, how about infill, Brad? I mean, I guess your considerations to that, you know, buying an existing park that's got a, you know, existing supply in place, and you might have to turn over some of that supply. You might have to convert some of the existing park-owned home inventory into resident-owned homes. And obviously, there's a demand factor there. You want to make sure that there's enough demand in the marketplace. But when you're taking over something that's got a high vacancy, to where the game plan becomes to infill, bring brand new inventory in, do you guys look at those differently? Obviously, demand is even more important at that point in time because you're selling brand new homes, higher price points. And a lot of times now, at least nowadays, I remember back when you and I were buying 10 years ago, a lot of times we wouldn't even, I can only speak for myself, we wouldn't put a lot of the value on the vacant lots. It was kind of icing on the cake. We'd want to know if there was demand in the marketplace for it, but like, it was icing on the cake. The deal didn't need that to economically work. Today, it's very different. You pretty much, if you're going to buy a major infill property, you're more than likely paying some future value for those lots to be filled.
I always thought that was an amazing advantage of the space, because if you were buying I was coming from the institutional world, and we never got credit. And so you always had to pay for vacant units in an apartment building, right? Just because you're like, well, I know I can fill it. This operator is underperforming. I don't get those for free, but we did. We had a good run where we were getting them for free from an underwriting standpoint. But yeah, if you have any sort of infill component, or you have a lot of park-owned home that you know, percentage that you need to convert, then the delta on stick-built housing, it needs to be even wider, right? That's doubly important. And so we've done a deal. We did a deal last year in Raleigh that was about 60% park-owned homes, which obviously, you know, that's not great from a Fannie Mae standpoint on a refinance. But I wouldn't have done that deal in a softer market in Ohio. Right. But Raleigh, like, okay, housing prices are
Raleigh.
It's Raleigh. So, you really have to be careful on value add deals when there's a bunch of park owned homes, a bunch of old homes, even if they're all tenant owned, but they're all 1982 single wides, right? Well, you know that at some point those are going to have to leave or be demoed or what have you. And some people will go to softer markets and not factor that in. It's critical on infill type of deals. If you have a private equity type of partner, big capital partner, you can actually push the envelope, I think, a little bit on the amount of hair that you're willing to take on with park-owned homes and infill. But once again, I see so many groups that will try to, you know, do this on a shoestring budget because it's either their first syndication or they're new to the space. And capital is a weapon now in our space. It used to be where you could just kind of buy them right and, you know, do a tenant notice and hit, you know, every metric, every IRR threshold you were trying to. trying to achieve. Now it's a pros game, and I feel like the groups that have access to capital really have a giant leg up now, because you can, there's so many more dials to turn. If you can actually improve a property, infill it, convert park-owned homes, whereas, you know, that wasn't as big of a deal, you know, 12 years ago.
What are you most excited about? I mean, lots of changes have occurred over the last decade in our space, and I think it's going to continue to evolve here over the coming years. You know, we talked a little bit before we started recording about even new developments, which, you know, they've been few and far between for as long as you and I have been in the business. You know, just not a lot of new supply coming to the marketplace. I do believe that there's some changes happening that are going to work to our favor that will allow maybe new product to be built. But I guess generally speaking. This is a little bit of a loaded question, but what are you most excited about over the next couple of years in our sector? Anything that you see coming down the pike that just gets you even more excited than we are at present time about what we're investing in and the legs that it has, you know, to just continue thriving for many years to come?
I love investing in deals and with groups that I feel like we can have a 30-year relationship with. So that's my favorite thing, is that there's very few investments that you can make where you think that there's a good chance I might own this thing in 30 years. That is very hard. Maybe, you know, an ETF in the stock market, you can feel that way. But just about every other investment, you have to watch more closely. You have to, you know, think, did I time this right? Is the valuation right? Do I need to exit because the future is not going to be as bright? And this is one of those spaces where it's very hard for me to envision scenarios where affordable housing is not going to be in huge demand. I don't, you know, maybe I'm missing something, but I can't think through how we go back to a 2006 where everybody is getting as much money as they possibly want to go out and buy a McMansion, and that's all going to work out, and then mobile home parks and affordable housing is no longer a need. I am more of the mindset that, you know, AI is going to do weird things to our economy and our job market, and affordable housing is hopefully going to be a bigger and bigger solution to that problem. And so, yeah, I just love the fact that my favorite thing is when we actually, you know, when the wire is sent and then you get the notice of the closing from your team or your partner. And that's my favorite thing in the world, because I think, hey, there's a good chance I might be getting cash flow and refinancings and the bonus depreciation benefits for decades, and that I might end up passing these on to my kids some days. How is what I like about this space, because I don't want to work with anybody or invest in anything that I can't envision doing it for the rest of my life. It doesn't always happen that way. Sure, there's going to be surprises. There's going to be partnerships that don't work out. There's going to be Godfather offers that come across our desk and the operator just decides that, hey, I got to take this because it's a giant, you know, payday for me. That's fine. But we've invested with so many groups that they're kind of past that phase. I think you're past that phase too, where it's like when you start out in real estate private equity, it's like, oh my God, we're not making much money. We're kind of using our acquisition fees to pay for our team. The asset management fees are not high enough. Like, we're just kind of keeping the lights on. And then you got to start like compounding some wins. You're able to buy your house if you're a young guy. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh no, we're good. Now let's just, you know, compound for the future and not worry about having to sell for the promote. And so that's kind of my favorite thing in the space.
You know, to your point, there really aren't many other asset classes I feel that way about that I know that I'm going to be excited that we still own, 20 years down the road. Like, I wouldn't have the same conviction with anything else, I don't believe. Maybe multifamily to a certain degree, but definitely not in the same realm as manufactured housing. So I agree with that. And yeah, our business model has changed. I mean, like just the fact that there's not a lot of new supply, right? Like, if you buy, I think there's a huge benefit of you buy an asset, you figure out what all the skeletons are, you work out all the kinks, right? Like, you understand the operations better than anyone else. To think about selling that and then having to go do it over again and step back into the unknown, I mean, there's a lot of risk associated with that. Whereas you could just let that annuity that you've already created, it's already a stable annuity, just keep producing for many, many years, many, many decades to come. So that's we've evolved to that to more of that business model at this point in time. Is like, how do we figure out a structure that we can truly hold these for multiple decades and not be necessarily forced to sell? Because we know that every time we're forced to sell to find our way to the promote, it's even inherently more difficult to find another equal opportunity to go out and buy. And there's obviously a lot of capital chasing the same sector, really no new supply coming into the marketplace. And so, trying to hold the great assets and, the cherries I think it's a good plan. And I think it's one that we'll look back in 20 years and say, that was a really smart move. So we
couldn't agree more. The deals that require a ton of capital and you have to end up, partnering with a giant private equity group to bring that quantum of money to a deal because it's 50% vacant, it's very hard to set those up for a 20-year hold. Usually they have to get out in 3 to 5 years. And we do those deals and they're fun. I like improving properties and being a part of that. But my favorite thing is when an operator, who has worked with private equity and is like, look, I chased this owner for 10 years or 5 years. I've been going to coffees with him. I've been trying so hard to get him to sell. And then my private equity partner, like, we do the business plan, we crush it. And in year two, they're like, we should probably think about selling next year because this is great. And you're like, yeah, the IRR is going to be fantastic. But like, I don't need a great IRR. I can't eat the IRR. I need to go and replace that capital. And people don't realize, how important reinvestment risk is, right? And, the best investors in the world always talk about these businesses that have high return on invested capital, which is great, but there's very few businesses where you can also put additional capital and generate those returns ongoing. And there's even fewer businesses where you feel like you have some sort of moat where those returns will continue into the future. And so this is, like you said, one of those rare instances where you do feel like you can have growing cash flow, a growing dividend over time, and not have to worry about where are we at this, at this point in the cycle, do we need to sell this thing because we've kind of top ticked it and it's going to be negative for the next 10 years. You can kind of just let it ride. And most investments aren't compounding dividend type of investments.
I feel like manufactured housing, as it relates to leased real estate, it really was the last hurrah. I mean, like, I can't think of anything else that, that could be an opportunity equivalent to this as it relates to real estate. I feel like this was the last frontier.
I've invested in a lot of them, mostly, when I was working at these larger firms, not as a principal myself, but, office is a trading investment, always has been, right? You have to get the timing right. Industrial is a little bit better, but it's still tied to the GDP, right? And global trade. Retail, of course, obviously has the same component to it. Hotels, the worst real estate business in the world from that standpoint. Like, it's nightly turnover. So all these things, all these other asset classes, you have to get the cycle right. You can do better in manufactured housing if you get the cycle right, for sure. But as long as you don't over leverage or put insanely short-term debt, like, good things are probably going to happen to you. And my thing then is, okay, so if we're in a great asset class, then let's focus on not doing dumb things. Because if we just do basic things, like, good things are going to happen, good returns are going to take care of themselves. And so for us, that is definitely diversification, right? That is definitely fixed rate debt. We didn't put on a lot of floating debt. I think I had one deal that had a floating loan in 50 some investments. So we try to focus on just not screwing up at this point. And for new investors in this space, my advice is always, like, don't go individual deals, like, go a diversified portfolio of parks, unless you can individually write $5,000 to $10,000, $100,000 checks and make your own diversification with operators or the same operator, right? I'm big on, hey, this industry, this asset class has such compelling characteristics to it. Like, you don't need to try to shoot for a 25 IRR on everything. And you probably shouldn't just have your one real estate investment into one deal. You should get exposure to multiple properties in this space.
Most parks nowadays, one could argue that, like, you could, even the price of your parks, you're still buying them for what would be below replacement cost. If you were to go rebuild that that entire community again, the roads, the infrastructure, including the price of the land. If it's in one of these markets that's above $250,000.
Yeah, it's 125K plus a pad.
Yeah, I was going to say 100K. I was just going to keep it simple and say 100K a lot, and that's before any income's coming, being derived from that lot. Is it an argument to make to say that, like, if you could go in that market, you could buy a community for $80,000, $85,000 a lot? The long-term horizon ultimately will take care of itself. Like, the investment will prove to be successful over the long run, even if in the short term, the returns might be, dismal.
So this is the hardest part in talking to somebody that comes from a real estate institutional background, because some of that math, right, doesn't really tie. You're like, well, wait a minute. So the lot rents of these other parks are X, and you're buying at 80K a pad. You say replacement cost is over 100, but near term, and based on the going in cap rate, this looks pretty anemic on a return standpoint. So what gives you faith that you can actually take lot rents sustainably to this point and you're not going to have a giant decline in occupancy? Well, if you've been in this space for 10 plus years and you've seen this story happen, time and time again, you have that faith and you have that conviction because you've just seen it so many times. And so that's the hardest part, is when you have somebody who has an institutional or private equity type of mindset on, or an engineering underwriting mindset. But yeah, of course, you can overpay. You definitely can overpay, right? Because insurance costs are, keep rising, and you might end up not being able to, maybe you underwrite the real estate tax, reassessment incorrectly. So I'm not saying you can't overpay, but as long as you're not dumb about it, it's hard to do. And then it's especially hard to do in a fund format. You almost actively have to try to screw this up across a diversified portfolio of these things. But on an individual basis, yeah, you're right. You can blow it for sure. And we see it occasionally with, 28% expense loads and it's 25% park-owned homes. I'm like, no, it's going to be higher to run the park than that. Like, you're not going to run this park with a greeter or somebody that, is doing it part-time and passing out rent increases and collecting rents on time. You have to have real talent both at the property and at corporate, and people on top of everything and going out to the property and driving the property often. And that costs money, and talent needs to be incentivized. So yeah, you can definitely screw it up with dumb assumptions. But like I said, it's harder to do in this space than it is in just about every other asset class within real estate that I know of.
I agree with that, man. Brad, this has been a fun conversation. It's funny that we've been in the space similar amounts of time, but I don't think we've ever had a deep conversation. I don't think we've ever met in person either. So excited.
Yeah, we've crossed many times, but yeah.
Appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. It's always good talking shop, especially with someone that's been in the sector and understands it intimately. I guess for those that want to learn a little bit more about, what you got going on, where's the best place to connect with you and for them to find more about your company?
Yeah, vintage-funds.com, Vintage Capital. We got a lot of resources on the space. They can go check it out and they can reach out if they're interested in chatting with us.
Awesome. I appreciate it, Brad. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me. Thanks, Kevin.
And guys, everyone listening, if you enjoyed today's episode, please do take a moment to subscribe to the show. You'll leave a rating review. It just really helps us continue attracting, experienced investors like Brad, and it keeps the podcast growing. And so until next week's show, wishing each and every one of you strong deals and even stronger cash flow. Take care.